It starts right out with the Stephen theme, you know, the awakening, and it immediately gets you into it. You think, well, that's how the last album ended. And this one's starting right up again. Of course, now the songs are totally different. We did not write this song to be the first song, but it was the Hello Hooray. It was the epic song. It was one you're not expecting. And Desmond Child and Bob and I worked on this song more than any other song on the album. This was the one that got changed 600 times until it said exactly what we wanted it to say. We wanted it to be, I am made of you, applying to two or three different worlds, you know. And in that twilight sleep, he didn't quite know who he was talking to. The great thing about this is when it came to that end, I told Steve Hunter, I said, this is going to sound weird to you. I want you to listen to the Carpenters Say Goodbye to Love. It's almost like a Jeff Beck playing the melody, but then letting it build into something that just is magnificent. I cannot wait till it gets to that solo part, because it is just the best solo ever, maybe on any of my albums. So I was really, really impressed with how Steve, and I wasn't there when he played the solo. But I gave him what I wanted to hear. He listened to what I was talking about. And between he and Bob, they came up with a solo that I thought the song couldn't get better until he hits the solo, takes it to another place, you know. And so this song is the masterpiece of the album, I think, is, you know, I Am Made of You. When we wrote this song, we started out with an idea. And for some reason, Bob said, this guy, Keith from Buck Cherry, he's got a studio in L.A. We should go talk to him. We should think about him as a co-writer on this. And I went, sure, I like that band. They're great. They're a good hard rock guitar band. Let's go. We sat down, wrote the basis for this song, you know, up at his studio. Then took it back to Nashville and then went crazy with it. And turned it into something that was just really only Alice could do, is this song, Caffeine. In fact, when Keith heard it, he just went, what happened? It went from a rock song to a kind of like a strange Alice piece, but it kept its balls, you know, all the way through it. And so he says, it really turned into something great. He says, I never thought it was going to end up sounding like that, you know. So we were all very, very happy with it. We just saw him at a show a couple of shows ago. He showed up. They were in town, and he came. He says, Caffeine sounds great. He said, sounds really, really good. So yeah, I always want to make the other writer, if he's not involved in the process, to come in and just go, wow, you know, I'm really proud of being a writer on that song. So that was great. It was good to have him on that. And I think we even went to a little bit of Big Bopper. Caffeine. You know, we figured a guy that's that hyped is probably going to be like that, you know. And it's comical. But I know guys like that, that the longer the day goes on, the more, you know, to the point where you want to go, stop, just stop, decaf, think decaf. But I wanted this to be really to the point where, you know, he's anything to stay awake. And even at the end, give me. He finally runs out of steam. He gives up the ghost. Nothing can keep him awake at that point. Gone. Out. This is a little piano piece that I always like the idea of a little kid at the piano inventing. I don't play piano, but I could sit there going, ding, 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 ding. Okay. I love it. Ding, 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 ding. You know, it's like a little kid playing with a piano. But with him, it was like a little lullaby. He wrote this little lullaby, and it kind of told a story, and it was kind of him going, I don't want to go to sleep. I'm going to keep doing this because I don't want to go to sleep. Doing anything to stay awake. But it kind of tells the story about he doesn't want to go to sleep. You know, he's doing everything he can to stay awake. Now, Runaway Train was a song Dennis Dunaway had on his album. Our original bass player, Dennis, is my oldest friend on the planet. And Dennis had a song called Subway Train. And I said, you know that song Subway on your album? Yeah. I said, can we take that and rework it? I said, I want it to be Runaway Train. And now, of course, we call it affectionately Dunaway Train. You know, I said, I have an idea for this, something that we've never done before. It's not going to have a chorus. It's not going to have a B section. It's just going to have a verse. And it's just going to have that train kept a rolling kind of roll in the drums. And it's going to tell a story almost like a Highway 61 imagery kind of Dylan story. When you think it's going to go to the next part, it doesn't. It just stays on this runaway track, going faster and faster and faster. And it was a bit of a gamble to do a song like that and not go to a chorus and not go to a B section, but it worked. Anything that you tried to write above it or beyond it didn't work. It just had to be this linear song. I was very, very proud of this. So when he finally heard it, he went, oh, yeah, he says, because it tells this really surrealistic story about waking up, being chained to this train with these 13 angry men, and them all going, you know, he said, but I'm a big celebrity. And they're going, well, you're not here. You're in this dream. And then you hear it crash. It's inevitable that this train was going to just crash. As everybody says, if you see a tidal wave, it means this. If you see this, it means that in a dream. You're on a runaway train that can't stop. It means something. It has some sort of psychological problems. Last Man on Earth, there was a takeoff. I said, Bob, do you remember The Twilight Zone with Burgess Meredith, where he hates everybody? All he wants to do is read. Everybody's a pain in the butt to him. There's a nuclear war while he's downstairs in the vault. Comes up, everything's gone. Everybody's gone. He is the last man on Earth. And all he wants to do is go to the library and read every book. He's got all the food he needs, got all the water, he's got all the supplies. He goes, this is heaven. I'm the last man on Earth. Looks down, his glasses fall off and break. He can't see a thing forever now. He's got the whole world and can't see anything. Great Twilight Zone. I said, I like the idea of Alice waking up in the train wreckage and going, I'm the only one left. I'm the last man on Earth. I can do anything. Nobody can say anything to me. I have no responsibilities. This is great. So we made it like a Tom Waits type of song. Doom, doom, doom. I'm the last man on Earth. And you know what it's worth. You know, it was kind of a dun, 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 weird little Tom Waits weird, you know, bar somewhere in New Orleans. And we added a tuba on it. We put the, you know, all these instruments that you would never hear Alice play. But it reminded me of Some Folks from the original album. Some folks love to see red. Some folks, it had that feel. So it was another good parallel there. With that voice, you can put the tuba on it. With that voice, you can put the clarinet. You can put all those instruments that let that voice come alive. It's so out there, it's good. You're not expecting this song at all on this album. Perfect. Let's use it. And it tells the story. It moves the story forward. But I love the idea of him thinking he's the last man on Earth, and theatrically he hears the applaud. And he turns around and realizes that there's an entire group of people there that he has no idea who they are. Until the guy announces who they are. Welcome to the congregation. Who's the congregation? Where are we? What is this? You know, he never does explain who the congregation is. He's just welcoming him to this place. A lot of Beatle melodies in this, a lot of Magical Mystery Tour kind of melodies, I Am the Walrus kind of melodies, but it moves the story along again to the point where he's now part of this place. If he wants to be or not, he's part of it. But let me give you a tour of this place. And when we get to the tour, then Rob Zombie is the curator. Over here in the flaming pit of eternal punishment are the defrocked priests and, you know, all the people that you kind of want to be in hell are there, you know, lawyers. And over here in the mariachi room, could there be anything worse than like eternally mariachi music? No. He says, we have this, 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 and of course, mimes. Because mimes belong in hell. Rob and I were on tour at the same time right then. So I said, Rob, you've got to do the voice of the curator of this place. And so he said, okay. Then at the end, the curator goes, I'm going to turn you over now to your guide. She will be your guide for the rest of this tour. This song and a couple other songs, you're going to hear some of these Broadway melodies and then another melody go over top of it, like a Guys and Dolls thing, and another melody, but in a rock phase. It's using something from Broadway in a rock vein, and the audience probably won't know where it comes from, but that's where it does come from. That's maybe my rebellion, is if you tell me that that shouldn't work, I probably will work my head off till it does work, and then shove it down your throat and say, see, I told you it would work. When you're putting Kip Winger and Rob Zombie on the same song, people would say, well, that can't work. Well, of course it works. It works fine. Bite Your Face Off is definitely on my tip of the hat to the Rolling Stones, early Rolling Stones, 1965, 64 Rolling Stones, when their songs were Chuck Berry oriented and very... It just feels so good in the pocket. And he's introduced to his guide. And she just kind of lets him know right up front, you know, this, I'm this, I'm that, she's beautiful, I'm this, but cross the line, I'll bite your face off. In other words, I'm your guide, I'm going to be nice, but don't cross any of these lines because I will bite your face off. And then, of course, it also is something that everybody in the world is going to start saying, you know, hey, don't bite my face off. You know, it's going to be a catchphrase, I think. We do the song now on stage. I have never done a song from an album that's out yet, but just is begging to be in the show. We sat there and I said, we got to do a Bite Your Face Off on the stage show. Okay, we've done it in four different continents now. Nobody's ever heard the song. The audience is singing it by the second chorus. I'll bite your face off. They can't wait to sing that part. And so I think this song is going to be the first hit on the record. It's just, it has every element of Brown Sugar or Honky Tonk Woman. It's got that hook that it just really is the perfect little 3-minute single. This song was a piece of a Neil Smith song. Neil wrote this little, he wrote this song, but it had this little piece in it that we pulled out and said, Neil, let's write on this piece and turn it into something. And we did, and it ended up being this song. So we have Dennis, Neil, you know, we've included everybody now, not just in playing, but in writing. I think that was really important. The girl then says, well, let's go to this dance club. And I said, oh, I hate dance clubs. No, you're going to love this one. Because it's a disco, but it's a disco with everybody's dead. You even get to kill them. He lines them all against the wall with a machine gun and mows them down, and they put them in the ground, and next thing they come back up again. You cannot kill disco. It was my way of saying, no matter what you do, you can't kill disco. It just keeps raising its ugly head. So the bodies on the floor and everything like that. And again, now the lyrics and the way that we approached the vocals was Guys and Dolls. It was disco dis, disco dat. When disc goes to hell, that's where it's at. We gave it that di, e, you know, we couldn't get away from the play on words, disco this, disco that. But it was Alice destroying a disco and realizing you couldn't destroy the disco. Disco bloodbath boogie fever, disco bloodbath boogie fever. If you play that in a disco, they'll dance all night to it. It's a perfect disco song. Johnny Five plays guitar on that, yeah. And we just kind of said at the end of this song, to make it worthwhile for me, it's going to end, and then I want rock and roll to avalanche over top of it. Bam! You know, all of a sudden, this rock and roll overcomes disco. And I said, Johnny's right here. I said, he plays that guitar, just an uncontrollable guitar. Go get him, you know. And I think he got it in two takes. When Rob Zombie and I decided to tour together, it was called the Gruesome Twosome Tour. I suggested Ghouls Gone Wild, because they have all these, you know, videos, Girls Gone Wild all over the, you know, thing. And it was just a funny play on words. I didn't want to waste it. So I said, Bob, Ghouls Gone Wild. It's in a nightmare. How do we make it work? And we decided that from the disco, she takes him to the beach party. And there's all the bikini-clad women out there dancing, except they're all zombies. In the nightmare, I'm picturing it going, this is great. It's all these zombies and parts are falling off during the swim. Ghouls gone wild. Da-da-da-da-da. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And Mark Volman from the Turtles lives there. We said, nobody sings this surf stuff better than Mark. Mark's been on probably 12 of my albums. And so, of course, he's singing on it. And we just created this horrible little surf song that is so catchy that you can't get away from it. I just thought it would be a great, you know, Jan and Dean, but with Alice's sense of humor. There's another song on From the Inside Album called Serious that kind of had this kind of changes where it just kept getting modulate to the next chord, modulate, keep modulating until it keeps getting more chaotic. In the end of it, not much to say about this song except it is what it is. He's dancing with a girl and somehow he is infatuated with her. The song ends, she's in his arms, but it's just a skull with blonde hair, a spinal cord, maybe a leg, maybe an arm because she's all fallen apart. And he sings the prettiest song he's ever sung. Something to Remember Me By. It was a song that Dick Wagner and I wrote back in, probably when we wrote I Never Cry, back in 76, 77, 78. But we never did the song because I never was able to sing it. I couldn't sing it as good as Dick Wagner could. He had a great voice. And it was rangy for me. I played the song for Bob, and Bob says, that is the prettiest song we've ever written. We've got to get it on this album. I said, okay, we finally got it in the right arrangement, and it worked. I really worked hard on this vocal. I had to sing it with the attitude that I'm not trying to sing it. And the idea of him singing it to parts of this girl made it even better. Because just a sappy love song can work. But the idea that he's singing it to not just a corpse, but part of a corpse. And in the nightmare, it seems totally okay. It's a little bit like Cold Ethel. So you've got another parallel there of, you know, Alice singing to a dead girl. It's so pretty. It's so heartfelt. It's one of those songs that, like, honestly, I'm really proud of this song because I didn't know if we were going to be able to write another You and Me or another I Never Cry or How Are You Gonna See Me Now. Those songs were just really touching ballads. I've always said, if you can make a girl cry with your ballad, it's a hit. Played this song for my wife and my daughters, and they just were going, it's very pretty, it's so pretty, you know, because it's touching. I'm leaving now, but here's something to remember me by. So that's the idea, is to break the girl's heart. Only in this case, her heart fell out a long time ago on the beach. Mike Bruce had a song about, it was almost from the pedophile's point of view. And I didn't like that idea. I liked the idea of the little boy thinking, you know, it's almost like Scrooge going back and the ghost of Christmas past, taking him back and looking at his life, looking at himself as a little boy, looking at himself in this situation. So that was the preposition in this. When Hell Comes Home was a nightmare about him watching himself as a 10, 11-year-old boy. His mother's abused. His father's coming home. And when father comes home, hell comes home. He's drunk. He's abusive. He's mean. He's vicious. So the kid at some point, the revenge factor comes up to the point where he goes, if he beats mommy one more time, he's going to come up the stairs to beat me, and I'm putting one right between his eyes. And he does. So when Hell Comes Home is kind of a nice revenge kind of song, but it is dark, really dark. And the band, the original band played live on this one. And I wanted a 70s feel, but I didn't have to ask for it. That's just the way they play. But when they got done playing the basic track on About, and I looked at each other and went, you know, in other words, we don't have to say, try to think of this as 1972, 73. They just play that way. And it was great, because, I mean, I knew that that was the original core band right there. That 70s sound is built into their DNA. That's what made it work. The way they finished it was a little bit ragged, but that's the way they used to finish songs. And that's what I like about it. So this was a good little revenge song. A little dark and a little moody, but after the last two songs, it was time for this song. Our guide, who's taken us to all these places that we hate so much, finally goes, by the way, time to pay up. He's going, what do you mean? And she goes, well, nothing's free here. What baby wants, baby gets. And he goes, I still don't get this. What do you mean pay up? Some nightmare. I'm not paying anything. And she starts explaining, I eat boys like you for lunch. Maybe you're going to start getting the picture of who I am. But let me just tell you one thing. You're going to pay. What baby wants, baby gets. That was her phrase. She just keeps saying to him. And he's going, I'm not understanding what you want me to pay. Well, you will. You know, we wrote this with Kesha, who is a closet rock star. She's right now in the Lady Gaga world of dance, and she's really good at it, but she writes her own lyrics. She's very good at what she does. I know she wants to be a rock star. I know she wants to have a band behind her. So I think later on she probably will. When we sat down to write this, I said, this is going to be another one of those ones where I think a lot of my audience is going to go, Kesha? And for me to look back and go, yeah, Kesha. She wrote probably the most disgusting lyrics in the song. Just because they're put in this pigeonhole doesn't mean that's what they are. We had to water down her lyrics. The lyrics she started with, I went, whoa, 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 whoa. Alice is too much of a gentleman to say that. We had a great time writing and singing it. She was ready. She came in loaded to do it. I mean, she just had no problem singing it. You want it more throaty? You want it more high? You want this? We got a really good performance out of her on it. I got to get out of here. Finally, he goes, look, I'm tired of this nightmare. I finally get it. Time to wake up. I gotta get out of here. He keeps singing that. And finally the choir goes, isn't it clear to you yet? What part of dead don't you get? And he goes, what? And they go, what part of dead don't you get? He says, this is a nightmare. And they go, no, you're dead. And he argues with them back and forth, you know, that this is just a nightmare. What part of dead don't you get? This is not hard. This is not Chinese algebra. You're dead. Now he's at that point where he does, now, am I dead or is this part of the nightmare? So, but it would explain what the last song was about when she says, pay up. You know, she was the devil. She's going, it's time to pay up. And we leave the audience with that. Is it part of the nightmare or is he dead? I always leave him with a little question mark. Instead of having an overture, we decided an underture would be good because in a nightmare, all the music would come at the end. And it's just the idea of relating a lot of the themes back to the nightmare. You hear parts from Welcome to My Nightmare. There's even little parts from other albums in there, little themes. But I love the idea of an underture. There's something exciting about going to a Broadway show, especially when you know the music, you know, to the producers or something like that. And they play the overture where you hear little pieces of each song and you can't wait to hear the rest of those songs. In this case, it's a recap of the two albums and a few other themes thrown in there. It was great to have. It just gave it a little more class, I think, to do an underture. It's a Broadway device brought to rock, and it's in disguise. Broadway is borrowed from rock. Now, I like the idea of borrowing from Broadway. What would Alice's probably worst nightmare be? It'd be working in a cubicle somewhere in an office building. How horrible would that be for him? 9-to-5 job. So a bad situation is him singing about, I've got a rusty old wreck. I work in this plane. I have no chance of sleeping with that girl over there. I have no chance of advancing my life. He puts himself in the position of being in that. It's a bad situation. It's a really bad situation. If I could, I would burn this place to the ground in a second. You know, a real nightmare thing for Alice would be that life. It was originally called My Favorite Mutation. And it was funny, but it wasn't pertinent to this. Lyrically, I had to change the lyrics to make it work for our situation here. So we changed it from, you know, My Favorite Mutation to a very bad situation. But especially for somebody that knows nothing but all of his life being able to get up when he wants to get up. What he does for work is artistic and satisfying. It's not mundane. It keeps his own hours. If you've done that all your life, the worst thing somebody could say to me is, be there at 9 o'clock, you work till 5 o'clock, this is your lunch hour, this is your quota. That would be hell for any musician. This song, musically, came out to be one of the best grooves on the record, one of the best rocking songs when, you know, it just accidentally ended up being that. We got to get out of here, got to get out of this place. I said, man, always been a big Animals fan. Let's do this song. Because I know that all fans are collectors. I wanted to do, actually we did 3 or 4 songs. So we did over-record a lot of stuff. Now, if Bob wants to use that stuff, I would like to. I would like a collector to say, I want this album 5 times because I want that bonus track, that bonus track, that bonus track, that bonus track, and that bonus track. I want all of them. It's not to get them to buy the album 5 times, but I know they want the collection. So give them a chance to have five different versions of it. I know people that have the records in Japanese. They just want the album covers in all the different forms. It's a bit of an obsessive thing, but you can't talk these people out of it. They want every version of it, you know. I like that. I think that's good. I'm kind of an obsessive person myself, you know, so I condone that myself. We changed the arrangement of it so that it actually changes keys, and it turns it into a different song a little bit, but it keeps the essence of it. I mean, I could never sing that like Eric Burdon. So we sped it up a little bit, made it more of a rock song, and did some key changing, dropping it up, dropping it down, putting it over here, putting it down. But it ends up being the essence of that Animal song.